Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, November 28, 2018. Activists take their fight over a high-profile detainee to the courts.
Karibina has been in detention for the last 6 months. The reasons for his detention are not public yet, but of course there has been an alleged investigation going on for the last 6 months. These factors have been asked, have been questioned by various bodies, including us, but they were not getting proper answers.
And Egyptian officials express fear over South Sudan's instability.
The situation in the Republic of South Sudan, it's a quite big security hazard as well. So Chad, Southern Sudan, and Libya are all sources for helping to export unrest to both Egypt and Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A human rights group is suing the South Sudanese Ministries of National Security Services and Justice for the alleged illegal detention of Carbino Wall, the owner of a Juba-based CAS security service. Wake Simon Wood reports for VOA from Juba.
Phillips Anyang-Gong, who is representing Carbino Wall, says his client's detention without charges violates several South Sudanese laws, including the Transitional Constitution, the Criminal Procedures Act, and the National Security Act. Anyang says his group, Advocates Without Borders, filed a suit against the Ministries of Justice and National Security at the Supreme Court nearly 2 weeks ago.
Carbino has been in detention for the last 6 months. The reasons for his detention are not public yet, but of course there has been an alleged investigation going on for the last 6 months. These factors have been asked, have been questioned by various bodies, including us, but they were not getting proper answers.
Anyang says his group tried to get answers from the National Security Service about what, if any, charges Wall is facing since being detained.
Been talking to them. Time has come now that the only person that can intervene is the Supreme Court of this country, whom we are asking that the Caribbean be produced before the court of law.
James Mayen, the undersecretary in South Sudan's Ministry of Justice and Constitutional Affairs, says the Justice Ministry is not aware that it's being sued by Anyang's group at the South Sudan Supreme Court. Mayen tells South Sudan in Focus he cannot comment more on the story because he has not received or seen any petition against the Justice Ministry regarding the case in question.
You will be commenting when you will see the petition. And since I have not seen the petition, I have nothing to comment.
Prisoners in South Sudan's Blue House broke into a store in the prison where weapons are kept in October, disarmed the guards and demanded that the government provide prisoners with due process. Wall, who was accused of spearheading the riot at the detention facility, told the VOA South Sudan in Focus about 100 empty prisoners were on the rooftop, about 50 were on the ground, and another 15 were inside the Blue House. The standoff was resolved peacefully after Wall's father intervened. The National Security Service issued a statement last month identifying Wall as a person on administrative detention pending a court martial. Anyang says Wall has been stripped of his rights to talk, move, or have communication with his lawyers. Last month, South Sudan's central bank ordered all commercial banks across the country to close Wall's bank accounts. Anyang says his group still has not been told where Wall is being held since the riot took place.
His rights are in violations. He's being held incommunicado and he's not allowed any access to his family, his lawyers, and of course even the outside world.
Anyang says the ministry's failure to charge Wall in a court of law violates his constitutional rights. The National Security Act gives officers powers to arrest and detain suspects. But Anyang says the manner in which the National Security Service treated Wall violates Section 54, Subsection 2 of the National Security Act 2014, which says arrested persons must be investigated within 24 hours. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
As activists mark the International Day of the Elimination of Violence Against Women this week, South Sudanese leaders say the focus should be on educating men and women about women's rights. Winnie Chirino has this report for VOA from Juba.
Hundreds of school children and women activists walked alongside a marching band to Nyakron Cultural Center, where events marking the 16 days of activism to end violence against women and girls kicked off yesterday. The theme of South Sudan's campaign is Make Peace Count. Awud Dengashwil, South Sudan's gender, child and social welfare minister, says many cases of gender-based violence go unreported due to lack of emergency numbers to contact. She says a lack of immediately available services and referral centers for survivors of sexual violence, the stigma attached to people who report such violence, and widespread ignorance about women's rights also makes it hard for women and girls to come forward. Atwill says her ministry is working to create awareness among communities on the need to end violence against women and girls.
This day is commemorated in all the states of South Sudan, and during the campaign, various activities supported by our partners are recognized to make people aware of the negative impact of violence on women and girls and to act against such abuses. According to the Gender-Based Violence Information System, in 2017 alone, 2,297 cases of gender-based violence survivors were reported, of which 13% of the reported cases were rape and 5% were sexual assaults.
South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makwe concedes that violence against women is likely higher in South Sudan than many other countries, but notes that some men experience gender-based violence as well. Speaking in Arabic, Marquez says there may be discrepancies between what police officers write in their reports and what actually happened.
What happens on the ground is sometimes different from what is written in the laws.
For us to stop violence against women is not just enough by writing down laws which says if this is done, the punishment will be that. This will not solve the issue. But you are just punishing, like you arrest the person and take him to court and then sentence him because he has committed rape. That is not a solution. What we need to do is to sensitize our people on this issue of violence against women.
Mustafa Somar, Deputy Special Representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, says violence against women and girls has become a persistent and universal problem. He says up to 70% of South Sudanese women experience physical or sexual violence at some point in their life. Somar says the United Nations is working with religious and traditional leaders to educate South Sudanese communities on women and girls' rights and to empower women economically.
Have stepped up to support ongoing efforts by the government and NGOs to enhance comprehensive actions for the protection of women and girls, and we are committed to support continued effort to roll out initiatives like the One Stop Center and mobile team aiming to reach out to more women and girls to provide emergency medical care, mental health and psychological assistance, and uphold their dignity.
The International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women is held each year to sensitize people on gender-based violence. It was first marked in South Sudan in 2007. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The social media lit up this past week about the story of Nyalong, a South Sudanese child bride. Sebit Madid is from Lake State, where Nyalong comes from. He tells Ayen Bior about the prevalence of child marriages in his community and the role that culture plays in the dowry system.
Child marriage is there, yes. It is there, prevalent in South Sudan right now. Not all over South Sudan, but in some tribes or some clans, it do happen. Even where I come from, it happens. And actually, the girl that just made news on CNN and other networks, it do happen as well. She's a child, as people may put it, because since someone's 17, she's 17 and
That's underage.
Based on my own reporting, I think that one of the reasons why this particular story struck a chord is because it's the intersection of two issues in South Sudan. There's the issue of child marriage, which does happen. And then there's the issue of the dowry, which is already a very contentious issue.
The dowry, my take is, times have changed. Those days it used to be so important in any marriage. Right now, we don't, even the people you say, they complain about it. Nobody is for abolishment, like you abolish the dowry. No. What people want is for it to be regulated. There has to be something reasonable. Like why that thing on Facebook made the news is because it's unreasonable. $10,000, 500 cows, 3 cars. If you put all that together, how many people can afford it? That's why, and that's how it affects the young men like me.
Is there anything else that you want listeners to know?
I would want the people to know that what has been reported is not what happened on the ground. There was an auctioning of the girl.
That was Sabit Madid from Lake State speaking to Ayen Bier from Nairobi, Kenya. Tomorrow, Ayen talks to Jock Madud Jock, an anthropologist in South Sudan who describes the age-old dowry system in South Sudan. Following a four-day visit to Sudan, Egyptian Defense Minister Mohamed Zaki said that Cairo and Khartoum share the same vision regarding threats facing the region. Zaki discussed with his Sudanese counterpart, Awad Bin Auf, military and security cooperation between the two African countries. Nabil Najim, an Egyptian specialist on African affairs, explained to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashinawi the security threats the two countries face and how military cooperation between the two nations would help counter those threats.
I believe very much that Egypt and Sudan both are highly concerned with the developing threats, both from the southern borders and western or southwestern borders as well. So the borders between Egypt and Libya is a hazard. The western borders of Sudan with Chad is another hazard. And there is always sort of, you know, threats from two major issues. The extremist terrorists who could use the desert pathways all the way to Sudan and to Libya, obviously. The other one is the drugs and human traffickers, you know, who could get secure with military gangs in that area. So obviously there is major developing threats which are highly concerning both countries.
So how would the new Egyptian-Sudanese military cooperation help securing the long borders and combating terrorism and illegal migration?
Major General Mohammed Zaki, Commander-in-Chief of the Egyptian Armed Forces, and the Sudanese counterpart have held a serious talk during Major General Zaki's visit to Khartoum, which started last Saturday. The Sudanese side has expressed great interest in tightening, raising up the military coordination, training, and exchanging know-how between the Egyptian Armed Forces and the Sudanese ones.
Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry said Egypt plans during its upcoming presidency of the African Union to give priority to security and peacekeeping missions. How would you think the new military cooperation between Egypt and Sudan contribute to that goal?
As you kindly mentioned, that Egypt is going to be sharing the African Union starting from next January. Sudan is geographically almost in a position to convey such vision and strategy, Egyptian vision and strategy, to the other neighboring African countries. So definitely Sudan could play a quite useful role to be a bridge for the military and security arrangements. You cannot also ignore the situation in the new Borno state, the Republic of South Sudan, and with the neighboring borders to that baby state, it's a quite big security hazard as well. So Chad, Southern Sudan, and Libya are all sources for either conveying stability
and peace, or helping to export unrest and instability to both Egypt and Sudan. By the way, Mr. Shoukry, the Egyptian foreign minister, will arrive in Khartoum this evening to attend a ministerial meeting tomorrow, Thursday, in Khartoum regarding the situation in Libya. It's called Libya's Neighboring Countries. That meeting is scheduled to discuss coordination of effort to support Libyan dialogue, especially on security and stability in the Libyan south. So if that target is being handled and dealt with, it will reflect positively on the stability situation in Egypt and Sudan.
That was Nabil Najim, an Egyptian specialist on African affairs. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst, Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at immigrants in Tunisia. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you prefer a big or small family? Why or why not?
Well, I prefer having a small family. Reason being, having a small family, it is better because financially you can manage that family and you can raise your children up to a certain level of education that you may want them to achieve.
A big family, in the sense that everyone has somebody to talk to, or there's happiness at home.
I prefer a small family because then it allows you to connect with each other more.
I prefer moderate because with a moderate family, a bond is created in such a way that even if you're so far away, you can easily reach and reconnect at every given time.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. More than 400 Ethiopian migrants stranded in Yemen will be airlifted home this week. This is the first time since 2015 the International Organization for Migration has been given the go-ahead for this operation to resume. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The first group of Ethiopian migrants were flown home Monday. By the time this voluntary humanitarian return operation, or VHR, ends on Thursday, the UN Migration Agency will have airlifted 418 migrants from Yemen to Ethiopia. More than a quarter of the passengers are minors. The agency's repatriation program was stalled shortly after Saudi Arabia began its bombing campaign against Houthi rebels in support of the government in March 2015. IOM says the operation was able to resume after the Saudi-led coalition and Ethiopian government gave it permission to access airports. During the past few years, the IOM voluntary humanitarian return operation has assisted many migrants to go home by sea. But agency spokesman Joel Millman notes returning the migrants by plane is a better, safer option.
In 2018, IOM's VHR program was able to assist 668 migrants to return to Ethiopia on ships across the Gulf of Aden. However, unstable weather conditions at sea combined with escalated fighting in and around the Al Hodeida ports posed major operational challenges in previous return operations.
Despite the ongoing conflict, poverty and desperation for a better life have caused a steady stream of migrants from the Horn of Africa into Yemen. But upon arrival, most of the migrants hoping to find work in the Gulf countries find the borders closed to them. As a consequence, thousands of migrants have become stranded in Yemen in miserable conditions. In 2017, nearly 100,000 migrants reached Yemen. IOM estimates the number of new arrivals will increase to 150,000 by the end of this year. Although Somalis and Eritreans are part of the mix, IOM reports the vast majority of those making the perilous journey to Yemen are Ethiopian nationals. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on migrants, French maritime police have issued a statement saying the number of migrants trying to make the crossing from Calais, France, to the United Kingdom in boats has exploded in the past couple of months. There have been at least 4 cases in the Maritime Police intercepting boats carrying migrants. 2 occurred last Saturday. Those who have been intercepted from the cold channel waters were taken to local hospitals where they are being treated for hypothermia. Reporter Catherine Field is following developments and spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about the recent spike in migrant crossing.
It's just been in the last 2 months that Border Patrol and Marine Police have been alerted to the fact that there are yet more attempts by migrants trying to cross by sea to the United Kingdom in inflatable boats. The numbers that they are giving really do point to this particular explosion. In general, for the whole year, there have been 37 attempts to cross the British Channel. 25 of them have been since October. Now, when you look at other figures, for example, 2017, there were only 13 attempts, and in 2016, there were 23. So there clearly is something going on. And when we look more closely at the figures, according to Marine Police, there have been at least 5 cases in the last week of Marine Police intercepting boats carrying migrants.
Now, they're trying to go in inflatable boats, which is very risky. So why are they taking this risk?
Depends who you speak to. If you speak to the Marine Police and the French Border Police, they say that these migrants are concerned that next March, when Brexit happens, that's when the United Kingdom leaves the economic area of the European Union, that there will be new border checks, that there will be even more controls at channel crossing points. So it'll be even harder to get across. And so if they try and get across now, then they have got more of a chance. However, if you speak to NGOs, they say, no, it's absolutely nothing to do with Brexit whatsoever. What it is to do is that these people smugglers have got more smart, that the people smugglers realize that they're not going to be able to get their clients through the old channel ports, putting them onto ferries. And so they've moved further along the coast, and they're using either these inflatable boats, or in some cases they've been stealing fishing boats that have been moored at night and trying to get them across that way. It's a very risky crossing. Even though it's only a 30-kilometer-wide channel, it does have a lot of traffic. It has, in any day, 25% of the world's maritime traffic passes through there. So the risk, not just of the big swells, and it's winter here now, so it's dreadful temperatures there, but also the risk of being rammed by some of the big ships or the ferries that go through that channel is really quite high.
Where are these migrants mostly from?
We're not getting any figures on that, and this is very interesting. We have heard that earlier this year there were some Iranians in that group, and then we've also heard that there were some Albanians. But since then, really since this big explosion has started in October, they have stopped giving out figures. So we're really dependent on some of the NGOs who are operating in the Calais area along that channel coast, and they are saying that a lot of the migrants who are in the area at the moment are from sub-Saharan Africa, mostly from that area, as well as from Somalia. So we're really having trouble getting exact data on these migrants.
That's reporter Catherine Field speaking with Kim Lewis from Paris. We now turn to Rwanda, where authorities say they are investigating BBC reporter Focus Ndaizira on charges that may include terrorism. Focus Ndaizira says he has not yet been informed of the accusations against him. Eugenio Imana has more from Kigali.
Focus Ndaizira went missing on a week ago. Until Wednesday, his wife and family did not know where he was. Ndaizira was allowed to speak to journalists when the Rwanda Investigation Bureau paraded him before the media. Ndaizira says they detained him around 3 a.m. last Wednesday when he was going to meet someone. They hid him in security facilities, but he doesn't know where precisely. He doesn't know what he's charged with. They are investigating. They will tell him if they finish it. Rwanda Investigation Bureau spokesperson Modeste Mbabazi says he's surprised at Ndaizela's comments. Mbabazi says Ndaizela confessed to terrorism plans. Mbabazi says the journalist is accused of crimes related with terrorism. He says these tools you see are explosives. He was going to collect them in Nyamirambo. He got information that he's preparing terrorism activities with his accomplices. Human rights activists have long complained about how police investigations are handled in Rwanda, including the practice of detaining suspects without informing their families. The RIB denies holding suspects incommunicado. Gatete Thierry is a human rights lawyer.
But I just told you it's a violation of due procedure of law. Police has the, must inform these people immediately upon arrest, or maybe sometimes 48 hours, 72 hours upon arrest. However, is that they can seek a judge's permission on matters of terrorism, usually, to keep the matter secret while they are looking for this, to doing this investigation. But the judge of the court has to allow this to happen.
The Rwanda Investigations Bureau says that it is still investigating Daizela, who remains in custody. But it says if convicted, he can be sentenced to 15, 20 years of prison. On Twitter, other journalists and colleagues have called for Ndaizeye's release, saying he's a journalist, not a terrorist. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. A human rights group in South Sudan has sued the Ministries of National Security and Justice for the alleged illegal detention of the past 6 months of Kurbina Wool, who owns CAS Security Service. The company provides security guards for a number of private institutions around Juba. Wool was arrested in April and placed under what's called administrative detention. Philip Anyang Ngong, Wall's lawyer, says his client's detention violates several South Sudanese laws, including the Transitional Constitution, the Criminal Procedures Act, and the National Security Act. He says his group, Advocates Without Borders, sued the Ministries of Justice and National Security 2 weeks ago. As the world marks the International Violence Against Women's Day this week, South Sudanese leaders say the focus should be on educating people about the need to respect women's rights. Wut Deng Achwil, South Sudan's gender, child, and social welfare minister, says many cases of sexual violence go unreported because women don't know who to call, the stigma attached to such violence, and the lack of referral centers for women and girls. And finally, after a four-day visit to Sudan, Egyptian Defense Minister Mohamed Zaki says Cairo and Khartoum share the same vision when it comes to threats facing the region. Zaki discussed the issues of terrorism and military cooperation with his Sudanese counterpart, Awad bin Auf. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Khalina Ishtakal by Lomerika Sun. We have been listening to Lomerika Sun with the song Kalina Shtakal, which literally means let's work. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
We'll create discriminations among our community. Let's stop doing this. Matagul kalamde, kalide jenge, kalide nyamnyam, kalide sorwiji, kalamade kulumakwe.
Ashangida ya shabam. Again, I must make a lamb day.